Hey, everybody, welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. I'm John Burke, and with me from across the pond is Matt Hudson from whatiwatchtonight.co.uk. Matt, how you doing, sir?
I am doing very, very well, my friend. I've got an itch on the back of my head. It feels like there's some kind of like raised birthmark there, some kind of number or something, 999. I don't know what it is, but other than that, I'm doing okay. Yourself?
I'm doing all right, you know, just hoping that there's no sign of the apocalypse pending as we dive in. I don't know, man. We do this all for you, Matt.
At the end done it. Of that's the it. Day. That's the winner.
That's right, folks. We are here to talk about the new film, The First Omen, which is not actually The First Omen, but it is The First Omen. Because it's
very,
is a
very
prequel.
Confusing when we're talking about the original film. Because I used to just call that, The First Omen. But now I can't call it that. I have to call it the old one or the original.
Or just The Omen, I guess, is the
correct
name.
Or The Omen,
name,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
But then I don't want people to think I mean the remake.
Well, no one would think that because that didn't happen. So everyone, I actually haven't seen the remake, to be fair. I just have heard it's not worth my time. I actually, to be fair to the rest of them, I've only seen The First Omen. The Omen. Because I've heard the other ones dwindle. I thought I watched the third one because I know Sam Neill is in it, but apparently I just watched clips of it because I do not have it logged on Letterboxd. So
I'll give my thoughts on those films later.
I own many, but I've only seen The Omen, the original Omen, and now The First Omen, which we're here to talk about. So before we do that, real quick, Matt, how are you doing? Is everything going okay over there in the UK?
Yes, everything is fine and dandy in the UK. It's busy here in Shea Hudson, getting stuff boxed up and ready to move on to new pastures, as I mentioned the other week. But yeah, still boxing and bagging up, pretty much ready to go now. So this could be the last Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast I do in my current surroundings, or it could be the second last, depending on when I get the AOK to get the moving truck sorted out. But I'm doing well. That's just taken up all of my time, though, which is excellent. But I am also very impatient, where it's like, I'm ready to go. Let's just get this done. But when I start boxing and bagging, I also then get very annoyed at the amount of mess that I have then created with my own stuff. It's like that thing where you think, you know what, I'm gonna clean the house today or whatever. You get halfway through and think, what have I done? But it feels great when you get to the end of it. So I'm surrounded by boxes and I do feel good that they're done. But other than that, can't really complain too much. Can't complain, won't complain, other way I'm not going to. How about yourself, though? You keeping Florida safe and well?
Yeah, doing fine over here. Just getting ready for the summer months. I work. As a teacher, we're off during the summer, but I get, as a professor, I get the option to take on summer classes, which I'm doing. And I'm also, as a student, because I'm going for my doctorate, which we've talked about on the podcast before, I will be taking summer classes. So it's like, it's summertime. My schedule is different because like the way my job works is different. Like it's all online. I don't actually have to go into the office during the summer, but I have like to check in and respond to emails and stuff. But then I'll be going to class more often. So it's a transition. We will actually need to address probably when we can record during the summer, because I think I have Wednesday classes at night from 5 to 9. So we might have to switch back to Tuesdays.
We can make it work.
Yeah, we always make it work. We've shifted our recording schedule many times over the years.
so much so, we don't even know how long we've been doing this show for.
Yeah, it's wild to think about when you actually start to look at the numbers, because it doesn't feel like we've been going forever, but yet it's been a long time.
7 years?
We started in 2017. Obviously, we've also changed formats because we were a monthly podcast, and then we became the weekly format. Like I think just before the pandemic, if I remember correctly,
and then pandemic
put all that in jeopardy. Yeah, because we were like, well, we're home. Let's watch movies that remind us what it's like to have, you know, fear and anxiety. And that was a mistake.
Contagion and stuff like that. God, they hit home far too much at the time.
Wreck. And yeah, it was, I mean, some good movies, but also
good
like
films, yeah.
It resonated quite poorly. That's the Bad Apocalypse episodes, if anybody wants to explore the dark times. But Yeah, but no, we're here to explore a specific dark time, and I think we should get into it. We've already mentioned we're going to be talking about The First Omen. This is a new film by a first-time film director, Arashka Stevenson. Excuse me, sorry, I had a scroll. It was cut off at the S, so Stevenson. She has directed a few different TV shows, but this is her feature film debut. I know a little bit more about her than I did yesterday because I listened to her interview on the Big Picture podcast. And, you know, apparently I thought her, and her story about, seeing Fire Walk With Me, the David Lynch film, at a bar with the sound off and that sparking her intrigue in film and then renting, David Lynch's Wild Hearts and that being the film that really, sent her off to go to AFI and become a director, is pretty wild. And she's, I would not have guessed that, because it seems like that started her interest in cinema. She didn't directly address if, like, some of the horror films that we have talked off mic that are clearly influenced this film. She never mentioned any of them in the podcast interview, which I'm intrigued to, like, did she know she was riffing on these films? Did someone else bring the ideas to her? Did she just see clips? Like, I'm curious to see how deep her film knowledge has gone since that initial spark. It seems, based on this movie, that she is done her homework, mind you. It's not a criticism. If anything, if she hasn't done her homework, she did a good job of faking it, because it seems like she's done her homework. I only know that she did her homework because I've been doing my horror homework for the last like 4 years, and I was super excited to see things that I'm like, I had not seen Possession, for example, from 1981 until last October when we did the first I don't even remember what we call the thing in the October horror madness.
Halloween movie Havoc.
Yeah, Halloween, yeah, whatever it was.
Horror movie Havoc.
Possession was our the one that got the buy, if I remember correctly, because of the way Shudder had it listed. And yes. I had never seen it, watched it. I'm sure I was somewhat aware of some of the clips because there are clips that have gone super viral, but we will not spoil this unless we decide to. And if we do, we'll give you plenty of warning, but we will not, initially we are not spoiling The First Omen. So, so that's the director. The film stars, Nell Tiger Free. That is her actual name. Ralph Innocent, Sonia Braga, Tafik Barhorn. Couldn't see if there was an R there. Maria Cabarello, Charles Dance, up for like 2 seconds. Bill Nighy and Nicole Soros. Is that one guy in here? The other? He's at the top.
There's like Andrea Arcangeli.
Well, there's the father that meets with Charles Dance. Father at the beginning, is that Father Brennan? Because I don't remember names of the characters.
That is Ralph Innocent's character. Okay. Father Brennan is also in The Omen, the 76 film.
Oh, interesting.
A very big part of that film. Yeah,
I have seen it, but it has been a minute. And I gotta tell you what I kept confusing it with is Good Omens from Amazon Prime, because it sets up the same. There is a major element that is the same in the Omen franchise of a. You know, the American politicians adopting the Antichrist. I'm crossing story beats from Good Omens and The Omen, which I, to be fair, both have the word omen in it. So it's not like it's clearly in the same vein. But the synopsis of this film is, when a young American woman is sent to Rome to begin a life of service to the church, she encounters darkness that causes her to question her own faith and uncovers a terrifying conspiracy that hopes to bring about the birth of evil incarnate. This is a prequel to The Omen. So I guess I don't remember in that film when you find out Damien is the Antichrist, but I went into that movie knowing that just from history, because the movie's from the 76, you said, right?
Yes.
So, like, I was very aware that was the setup of that movie going into it. So I don't know if anyone could walk into The Omen completely blind of that fact today. But if you didn't know that, I apologize for already spoiling it for you. But how is this film being received? 77% on Rotten Tomatoes for critic score, 64 audience score. And I'm going to discuss why I think that might be, but 64 Metascore, 7.0 IMDb user score, and a 3.5 Letterboxd.
Not bad.
I will say, as far as prequels go, and if I don't feel like this falls into the legacy sequel vein, only because it is a prequel. I don't feel like it can't erase 2, 3, and 4 yet, because it doesn't, it's not concerned with those yet.
Yeah, this is a prequel. You look at certain films like The Exorcist Believer, which is a sequel, but it may as well also just be a reboot, a very, very soft one, mind. But yeah, it's the same beats. This one isn't, which I was very pleased about.
Yeah, and it's a true prequel. It is going to connect to the Omen, but it is a standalone thing for, like, I would say 90% of this. You don't need to have seen the Omen. And if anything, if you've never seen the Omen, you don't have to watch that before seeing this, because I think you could watch this first and then go in the order as designed. And I don't know if that's always true for prequels that come out, but this one does feel very much, it's at service to the original while telling its own story. And that's what makes it a kind of a standout. Now, that said, I'll also say it kind of suffers from timing, because Immaculate came out, 2 weeks ago?
Dude, yeah.
And is very similar in its overall story and themes, which we did not cover Immaculate formally on the show. We've talked about it in our and what media consumption both weeks, I think, because we saw it separately and at different times. But I do think the timing suffers for that. And yet, it's also, for a film teacher, it is extremely exciting, because you're seeing the culture influencing the art in a big way. Clearly, the people who are writing these stories have thoughts about some of the political things that are happening, especially here in the United States, the turning of Roe versus Wade. And you're seeing that trickle into the art that we're getting. Because while these two movies are both mainstream releases in theaters everywhere, I saw a third film this year at South by Southwest that is also dealing with a very similar thing. Now, not an American film, so it may be a coincidence, but it's still like a very similar overall premise. And I will say up front, I do like this movie. I think The First Omen is very successful. I think Immaculate is a little bit more successful for me, partly because Immaculate doesn't mess around with time. It's 90 minutes, it's in and out, and it's like boom, boom, boom. This movie lingers a little bit. I think there was a little bit of room to trim this down and it be a little tighter. And I gotta say, and this is a problem with me in horror in general, sometimes the tone of horror movies feels silly or goofy to me. And I don't think it bothers a lot of other people like it gets to me. And there were moments in this where I was laughing because I thought it was kind of, it was like not quite jumping the shark, but it was like, oh, really? That's how we're gonna depict this? And then by the end, those things didn't bother me anymore. But like in the moment, I think I was still on the fence. Like, is this really going to pull it off? And it does. And so I had much more overall positive feelings when the film was over. I never really, I never took Immaculate to be silly. There were some parts of Immaculate I did, like, I'm like, okay. These are we're just hitting the beats that you expect to hit. But by the end of that film, I was like floored, because I didn't expect the third act to be what it was.
It lent into its premise very much, though, did it, that film?
It did. This film, I think, delivers in a lot of ways better, and it takes, I think, bigger risks with a lot of its visuals, especially when you realize it's associated with Disney now, because it's a Searchlight film, if I'm remembering correctly. And there's a few images in this that you're like, oh, wow. And Big Picture did mention that, too. And I thought that was a really good point that Sean Fennessy made about some of the images. And one of them, apparently, how she sold them on making this movie, why it was her and not someone else to do this. And that's incredible and impressive for a lot of different reasons. The performances in the film, especially because Nell Tiger-Free, I don't think has done anything major. She's in a few other films, but nothing I have seen. And she's pretty good in this. Like, she's able to be inviting and welcoming at times. I do feel like some of the interactions feel a little melodramatic or a little over the top, but that might be paying homage to the 70s horror of it all. And a thing I really liked about this, and something that I tend to like, is I don't want my horror films to rely on jump scares. to be quote unquote horror, right? Because some people, that is their definition of horror. If there's no jump scares, it's not a horror movie. And that's where I think you're seeing the audience score take a dive a little bit, is I think it's much more contemplative and atmospheric than it is that way. Like, it's not trying to jump at you and, you know, like, oh, here's a cat. Like, you know, so many movies that just fall into those tropes or almost fall into the let's recreate a Universal Studios Halloween Horror Nights house rather than tell a really compelling story with interesting characters who are going through something horrific. This movie lands much more in that camp, and it's great because of that. I think it has some room to tighten up a little bit. Some of the performance choices or some of the dialogue choices feel a little rough. There was a part where a character witnesses a death. I won't say how or what, so it's not a spoiler, but she reacts in a way that felt like, I get that she's in shock, but also like the physical like blocking of the sequence feels so crazy. I'm like, I don't think that could have happened the way you're depicting it here in a way that like would work. This requires spoilers to really sell my point, but nevertheless, I'm not going to spoil it for the moment. But there were little things like that for me felt just off slightly with the tone. And again, maybe that's just me not really getting the campy horror or that kind of thing, or like not realizing that's what they're going for, because it is so serious at the same time. Like the overall message of the film is super serious. There's an air of silliness, I think, with this premise, that especially when you connect it to the franchise, that like the franchise goes real big at one point. Even having not seen them all, I know what happens. Yeah, I read about them prior. And yeah, I think overall we see a lot of promise from this filmmaker, which is exciting because we've been getting some really cool horror filmmakers the last few years. Maybe it's probably getting into like last 6 years that we get Jordan Peele entering in, then we get Ari Aster, and we continue to see these filmmakers with a lot of promise. And that's exciting because I like the idea of diverse perspectives in horror. I like the idea of different types of horror films. And I think, you know, we know studios are so IP driven that to get a movie like this that could have been just a cash grab type thing and it have an individual voice, have some sensibility, and also still do something positive for that IP rather than something where it just feels like this was a surefire property, is refreshing. So like all of the above, I'm really happy with the first Omen, and I'm curious, Matt, because I know you like it, want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, good points there, JB, and I absolutely enjoyed this. I love this film. In fact, it's not without its flaws. A lot of my let me rewind a little bit. Some of my positives simply revolve around the fact that I just thought this was going to be awful, and I know I'm not alone in that, but a prequel to a horror classic, of which The Omen is a prequel 50 years later almost, you know, what are they going to do? What can they bring? That, how can they ruin the mystique, if you will, of the Antichrist of Damien? Why are they doing this? All of those questions came up. So my relief was palpable when I realized that this film was actually really quite good. And I also, on the immaculate thing, yeah, the timing there was wild. It's crazy. I also wonder if Disney, basically, because this is a Disney film, if for all intents and purposes, I don't think they marketed this film as hard as they could have done, maybe in the week leading up to it. I wonder if they didn't realise that this film would be quite as well received as it has been. Box office would say otherwise. The box office hasn't been great. But then I attribute that to the film not being put in front of people, because maybe they didn't think it was great. Maybe they looked at the thought, oh Christ, we've got Immaculate coming out. Will it confuse audiences or our own target audience if we butt up against that too much in the marketing? Additionally, did they also think, well, we don't want to move this because we don't have much faith in it? No pun intended. It's very interesting to watch, because you can't help but think about Immaculate when watching this. I think it's impossible. If you've seen Immaculate before this, you cannot help but reference it whilst watching the film. Not necessarily comparing it, but you know, there are similar beats. They're both religious horror. They both involve nuns. They're both in a monastery. They're both in Italy. There's so much going on there, but I agree with you on the timing and the pacing. The pacing of this film didn't bother me. Could it have been trimmed here and there just to tighten up? Yes. But I love a contemplative horror. I've mentioned that before. I do like a slow burn horror that really, as long as that payoff is there. Immaculate had that payoff. It wasn't slow burn. It had slower moments. But does it have the payoff? Now, a lot of people would argue that this film didn't have the payoff. I'll get to that shortly. But I didn't mind the pacing. The difference with Immaculate, though, was it didn't have to tie into anything. It was its own story. It was its own thing, and it could do what it wanted, and it wasn't beholden to anything. Now, The First Omen is beholden to The Omen. It's a prequel, so whatever happens by the end of it has to line up with The Omen. So, therefore, Arcadia Stevenson's hands are already tied somewhat there, but that's the risk you take when you do a prequel. And are there moments in this film which do not fully line up with the original Omen? Yes, there are. There are some which I know just from seeing and reading reviews. Some people are furious that they've changed the lore. Well, actually, I think if you squint, it works perfectly fine. But you know, you mentioned that you watched The Omen and you knew who the kid was and everything going on. This film is setting that up. They make no bones about that. But to some people, that may hamper their experience knowing what happens or seeing that there is a tonal shift in those last 20 minutes, 15 minutes maybe, where the film suddenly is becoming a connective bridge rather than its own thing. Because I think this film is a damn good directorial debut as an artistic piece from Stevenson. I really think she directs the living hell out of this. It is very much... It feels like it's the 70s. It feels like it was shot back then. The DOP, whose name eludes me, the cinematographer, together, they do such a good job of making this Aaron Morton cinematography feel like it's from those times. It doesn't feel like a modern film. It's got that little bit of grain to it. They really capture that essence well, I think. And Mark Corvin's score is a fantastic companion to Jerry Goldsmith's score for The Omen, which of course won the Oscar for Best Score, one of the most haunting things I've ever heard, that is. So I think as a technical achievement, I think The First Omen is fantastic, and I know that most of the effects were done practically, which I'll always be a huge fan of. I think the performances are good. I think Neil Tiger Free is really very good in this film. Like you, I didn't know an awful lot about her. I didn't know anything about her, in fact, let's not lie. I didn't know who she was, but that's on me because I don't really watch TV and things. But I know she's been in films that I've seen, but as minor characters. But I think she is really, really good in this. She has to carry this film. And I don't mean because the supporting performances aren't good. In fact, the supporting performances, I think, are really very good in this film. You've got Sonia Braga, Maria Caballero, and Nicole Sorace. I think they're great. And then Ralph Ineson and Bill Nighy come in and do their thing as well. I think the supporting cast are really, really solid, but Noah Tiger 3 has to carry this. And you mentioned Possession. There's a moment in this that I, as soon as I watched it, I was like, man, that feels like Isabel Adjani in Possession. It just evokes it so much. And there is a real giallo feel to this film as well, but it evoked it so much. Now, I don't know if that was like a loving homage or if it just was the way things were, but I think I think she's great in this now. I also think the imagery for this film is surprisingly heavy. There's a lot of scenes in this where people in my screening, it wasn't a full screening. It was only I went to see this just after lunch on a Friday afternoon, but it was a fairly decent crowd. But there were a few moments where I could hear people's toes curling. I could hear people kind of inhaling as something was being shown or about to happen. And, you know, I really, really enjoyed that. And there was one moment where my toes curled. I was like, that is a rough visual to watch. And the jump scares, I think, were minimal and they were in service to the film, apart from maybe one where, you know, someone's looking at something and a hand grabs them and it's just their friend. But otherwise, I think they're really, really, really good. And there's one quite restrained jump scare, which I really, really thought was great. Dialogue. I'm with you. Dialogue's fine. It's nothing special. I think the performances sell the dialogue more than the dialogue sells itself. For me though, it really was the surprise because I thought this was going to be terrible. I just thought it was going to be a cheap cash in on the name. How can we make a film for a quick buck and use IP? Because horror, like most other genres, is is what one of the most IP driven genres out there now. I mentioned The Exorcist, and then you've got things like Five Nights at Freddy's recently. And if you can make a requel, prequel, sequel, Lego sequel to it, Halloween, they're going to do it. So I did think this was going to be awful. The trailers looked good, and I really liked the poster. But the lack of marketing worried me. The fact that the press screening was the night before in the UK worried me. But I put that solely down to 20th Century Studios, Disney, and the PR teams for just not, you know, having faith in what they had. But yeah, I think, listen, is it a perfect film, John? No, it's not. Like I say, I think the revelation that this film kind of tries to drop just as the third act pulls into view, I mean, I think most people probably saw that from a mile off. But the film plays it like it's a big revelation. Does it tie in immaculately, pun intended, with The Omen? No, it doesn't, but I'm not somebody who cries too much about that. I know a lot of people have been very upset, but I think it ties in as well as it needs to. There are a few moments where I thought, you know where the story goes. There wasn't I don't quite know why that particular character is acting like that, because it is actually wholly at odds with how they are in the original film. But, you know, that is what it is. And the way that the film ends, I thought was very interesting. Surprising, considering the lack of marketing, but very interesting. I really can't wait to see what they do, because like you said, The Omen isn't its own thing. There's The Omen, there's Damien, The Omen 2, which is a very serviceable horror film. I think it's actually very underrated. And then you've got the final conflict, Omen 3 with Sam Neill, where he is, I think that's his first kind of major role, and he is hamming it up. He's giving his most theatrical performance. And I think it's an okay horror film, but it is diminishing returns. And then The Omen 4 was made for TV, and it's crap. It's just really not. So they have their continuity. They already have that. So I'm interested to see what they do with it. But yeah, no, I think for me, though, this is one of the best prequels I've probably ever seen, just in terms of keeping that tone, keeping that as much connectivity as possible, but also not being a pale imitation. Is it as good as The Omen? No, I think The Omen is it's damn near flawless. It's got some of the most like muscle clenching scenes. The scene in the cemetery in The Omen where Gregory Peck's character, and they go to these graves, and it is one of the most tense scenes I've ever seen. I rewatched it the other day, and I know what happens, John, but I'm sitting there like, Jesus, how are they going to get out of this? Because the music is blaring, the sound design is great, the before everything about it is insane. But I think the first Omen was a very, very solid addition to the canon. I think it's one of the best prequels I've seen in terms of just adding to the story. And I don't think it was the cheap IP cash in that I worried it was going to be. It's better than The Nun, that's for sure. But as its own film as well, I think it's very, very good. Does it suffer from prequelitis at the end? Yeah, it does. But I think they handle it well. So yeah, very impressed by the first Omen, John. I thought this was great.
Yeah. And there you have it, folks. I think we both really enjoyed the film, and it's one of those, it's a really good example of what can be done with an existing IP. Again, not perfect, but considering some of the other prequels and or Lego sequels, especially if David Gordon Green gets his hands on it, this is leaps and bounds superior in our opinion. And again, according to a lot of those scores out there, I don't know if I read the rest. I feel like I got distracted, but
no, you did. You did. Metascore,
okay, man. I'm like, I don't even remember. I remember saying the RT scores, and then I feel like I went off the rails. But
I was about to say The Power of Christ Compelled You, but that's the wrong film completely.
No, wrong movie. Although I did wear my Exorcist shirt when I went to see this. So
good man,
there is that. All right, folks, we're gonna move into our next segment: Concessions of a Cinephile. This week, this is a segment where we're imagining that we're standing at the concession stand. We've bumped into each other, and we're going to chat it up while we're waiting to buy our popcorn and soda before the movie. This week, specifically, we're talking trailers. This is trailer talk, because we had two big trailers drop this week, and there's going to be more because CinemaCon's going on right now. A lot of those things will be held. They won't always reveal, like, CinemaCon stuff doesn't always leak right away. But you're hearing reports about like Beetlejuice 2 and stuff, but those have not, nothing new has dropped yet. But so far, Maxine dropped Monday from A24. It is the third movie in the Ty West trilogy. Pearl X and now Maxine with three X's in the title, which is, if you've seen X, you know why. And all three star Mia Goth, but she is, this is the same character from X, but a different character from Pearl. And I believe she's only playing one character in this movie, so she just had her double work in X. But if you recall the podcast, Matt and I were both really big fans of X and Pearl. Had Mia Goth as my, I think she won my best actress because of the monologue from Pearl. So I've been
so good,
really excited for Maxine. I didn't know who all was going to be in Maxine, and I also didn't know it was going to have what appears to be a neo-noir vibe. So I'm all in on Maxine. This trailer got me so excited. It's supposed to, I think it's June that is scheduled to come out. So it's not that far, especially the way this year is going, because it's already April. So like the year's flying by. I am extremely pumped. You know, Kevin Bacon's listed. You see him in the trailer, and I was like, oh man, because to me, I had like it reminded me of Wild Things a bit, L.A. Confidential, and oh man, there's one other movie that I was like, it was like really like, oh, this feels like that. And of course, I'm still not sure exactly what to expect from this movie, because I have to assume there's going to be a little bit of the horror element embedded in this, but how that was going to play, it feels a little bit more like a mystery and a detective story. I'm really pumped. The trailer is really good, and this year feels like A24 just decided to own it, because the big studios seem to be floundering this year. Like, there's not a lot of major releases, but A24 is just dropping like movie after movie after movie after movie that is either really good. I've seen several already that I love, and there's several coming out that I'm like, I can't wait to see these. So, Matt, what was your thoughts on Maxine?
Yeah, I thought the trailer was really interesting, because it's the first real look at the film we've got, and it doesn't give an awful lot away, which is what I like. So there's you've got the serial killer whose name, for some reason, I've already forgotten what they called them again, but it's a real life serial killer. The it's seemingly based on a real life person, which, interesting to see how that's going to go. The Night Stalker, interesting to see how they're going to play that. Obviously, you get to see the Bates Motel, which is so cool, just to see Maxine standing in front of that. I was like, hell yeah. And just as a jumping point off of X and Pearl, I was in anyway. And what I love about what Ty West is doing as X is your kind of sleazy exploitation 70s slasher film or whatever. Pearl is this technicolor psychological horror, almost, much slower in its burn. Whereas this, like you say, is more of a neo-noir 80s slasher, like Scream in the 80s or something, because you don't know who the killer is. And it could be anyone in this trailer. It could be Kevin Bacon. It could be Elizabeth Debicki. It could, well, I'm going to be Housing, I don't think. It could be Giancarlo Esposito. What a great cast already, but... The cast is spot on, man, but I love the contrasting tones through these. It's a trilogy that somehow, well, it has, we don't know yet, but it's a trilogy that shouldn't work just based on how different everything is, but it looks like it's going to. I thought this looked great. I thought the actual visuals of it looked very cool. It looks like something from the 80s, but it doesn't also feel like we've had a glut of 80s inspired films recently, which look like they're trying too hard to fit into that time. It looks a little bit more natural. Again, I haven't seen the film yet, but it looks a little bit more natural. Mia Goth, you are Goth, we all Goth. I'm not going to get that in again. Looks great in the role. I think she is one of the best in terms of the genre, and one of the best genre actors we've got going out there. And man, if I can link this into the first Omen, Nell Tiger 3 is spectacularly good, I thought. Toni Collette was spectacularly good in Hereditary. You know where I'm going with this. Mia Goth was spectacularly good in Pearl. Nobody gives a damn. They're always overlooked because, and I don't know why, because for me, horror is the genre where actresses and actors can really get their teeth into a role which involves more than just certain things that other actors who do get nominated get to do. You know, I think what's like, certainly with Mia Goth in Pearl, although she's excellent, that monologue, how long did that go on for? That is an absolute monster. And then staring at the screen for the last, for the whole credits and that. Obviously, there's more to it than just pulling faces and that. The depth that she managed to go to, similarly to Toni Collette. And I think Neil Tiger 3 is similar. I thought she's so good in the first Omen. I just wish there was more recognition. Awards don't mean anything to everyone, but I do wish there's more recognition. But for the trailer, though, I thought it was great. I don't know who the killers are. I don't know where we're going with it. I don't know how it's all going to end. We know that Maxine just wants to be famous. She wants to be a star. Maybe she will be for the wrong reasons. Cannot wait to see where this goes. And I think it's going to be another success in this Ty West trilogy. But yeah, colour me excited. Yeah. Do you think we'll get another Maxine trailer before it comes out?
I kind of hope not, just because I'm content with going in with what I have. Like, I don't need anything else to convince me. I haven't paid much attention to see if non-cinephiles are super hyped for this or not. So, like,
this is a good point.
And also, I don't know. You know, this dropped on YouTube. This feels like it should have been in front of the first Omen, maybe, instead. Yeah. I don't know if it's going to be in theaters this weekend. And I'm like, there's not really a horror film coming out this weekend. It could be in front of Civil War, because that's A24, so it would make sense that Maxine's in front of that. I hope it's going to get some theatrical play, just because I don't watch a lot of TV, so I don't know if Maxine's getting, like, I don't know if A24 trailers get a lot of TV rotation anyways. Like, I think Civil War.
I haven't seen a Civil War advert at all on the TV over here.
Yeah. The marketing seems to be super social media based for Civil War. Cause that's also really hard to note, because my social media is basically wrestling related content and movie related content, and that's it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if I'm just seeing a lot of Civil War stuff, or if everybody is seeing a lot of Civil War stuff. And we are talking Civil War, the film, not the impending nightmare of actual war. But I jumped in with this, and I gave my thoughts on Maxine first. I'm going to flip the script, though, for the second trailer, Matt.
Okay.
I have no idea what you thought about Joker Foley Adu. We talked about this on the podcast 2 weeks ago, that it was announced it's going to be a jukebox musical, and that there were 15 songs used, and maybe some room for original songs. And we speculated on what songs might be there. Only one song is heard in the trailer, and it was not on our list.
No,
but Matt, what were your thoughts on the trailer, and is your hype up or down or the same after watching it?
Well, what the world needs now is what the song was by Burt Bacharach. Does the world need this sequel to Joker? So I watched this trailer. You sent it to me very kindly, and it feels very much like a continuation of that first film. It does look, it's shot exactly the same, which, you know, I appreciate that. I think I was slightly more up on Joker than you were, JB. But so watching this trailer, I'm not entirely sure what to think. What I do like is that they seem to be going in with the musical aspect. Yeah, we didn't get they explain in the trailer that music is, you know, for paraphrasing, music is kind of what binds us together in our madness, or whatever he says. My issue is now kind of how the music is portrayed. I mean, the musical aspect of it, is it going to be happening? Is it going to be like a dream sequence all the time? How are they going to do that? But so I knew what to expect from Joaquin Phoenix's Joker. We'd already seen him, and there's no surprises with what he does here. He's not in a negative sense, but he's doing the same thing. He's, you know, continuing that character. So what was to be expected from Lady Gaga's Harley Quinn, considering we've just come off the back of many, many Margot Robbie Harley Quinns? I think Lady Gaga looks good as Harley Quinn. I think she's shown that she's a very capable actress already, so I don't think that should be in doubt. An Oscar-nominated actress. And I think she looks good in the makeup. I think the two of them look good together. But as a trailer, I thought it was fine. That's what I'll say now, JB. The film's not coming out for another 6 months to the day almost, but I thought the trailer was fine. I didn't quite get the full-on musical aspect that I thought. I'm glad that they mentioned, you know, the music side of it, and they kind of lent into the sound, the soundtrack aspect of it with the Burt Bacharach song. But I didn't think it was great. I didn't think it was bad. If you like that first film, I'm interested to see what those people think, because it is a musical and it isn't what we mentioned that ad nauseum last time. But I don't know, it was interesting. It's interesting. I'm still pleased that we're getting it, in the sense that it isn't just Joker 2, let's, you know, shoot Robert De Niro again or whatever. They're changing things up. I said that in the last episode we spoke about Folie à Deux. I'm really pleased that they're taking a risk. You know, the film made $1 billion, so they've earned themselves that opportunity. So I'm glad that they're doing something different. But this trailer didn't fully prove to me that it's going to be massively different. But we'll see. I was, you know, interested in it, intrigued by it, but I was not blown away. How about yourself, though, JB? Because I know that your thoughts on that first film, whilst not like overly negative, I don't believe it, you know, they were tempered compared to the rest of the
fandom. My initial thoughts, which I think might have been captured on the podcast, was like a lukewarm feeling towards it. Over the years, because of the amount of love that Joker got, I did get more aggressively anti-Joker, partly because I just felt that it's getting too much appreciation from people who maybe haven't given the source material a view, right? They haven't watched Taxi Driver. They haven't watched King of Comedy. I think I mentioned this on the other discussion. And so I have really ultimately soured on it. And partly because I don't think Todd Phillips has anything to say in that film. Like if you watch Taxi Driver, and I have no issue, you know, Tarantino and Edgar Wright, both directors who I like very much and notoriously borrow from existing property, right? Like their whole style is this postmodern, look at the movies that inspired me, right? Style, but they always have something new to add. Phillips just felt like he was like recreating, with no real intention or purpose, or maybe even real understanding of those movies. If anything, it felt almost more like he misread those movies. And that was a concern I had with Joker, was that like, it doesn't feel like he's being condemned for being this anti-hero, where, you know, De Niro and Taxi Driver, you're like, oh boy, Travis Bickle is a nightmare. You're not like for him. You're not like, oh, I get what he's going through. You're like, oh God, what is this guy going through? And you get that Scorsese got that. And I never got that feeling from Todd Phillips. And I was interested because I'm like, oh, it's a musical. So that means Todd Phillips wants to make a musical, but no, you know, the studios don't love to greenlight musicals. We've seen them bury the fact that Wonka, Color Purple, and Mean Girls that came out in the last 4 months were musicals. Like, they didn't sell that in the marketing because they were afraid it would push away audiences, which Wonka has proven otherwise. Wonka's made money. All three of those were good, but not pushed. So the fact that they came out and said this was going to be a musical, especially when they're the major fans from Joker, I don't think are fans of musicals on a regular basis. So I was really hyped, and now I'm less hyped. Partly because what I've read a few quotes from Todd Phillips at, I think, CinemaCon, where the trailer dropped, and it sounds like he's not selling it as a musical. It feels more like he's selling a music video. Like he said, music was a big part of Joker. I think his character's musical. Like, he wouldn't commit to it being a musical in the sense that they're singing the songs. And the song we're hearing in the trailer is clearly not the original Burt Bacharach version of What the World Needs Now that we've heard so lovingly used in Austin Powers. But instead, it's a kind of cool cover of it, but it's not Joaquin and it's not Lady Gaga singing it.
Yep.
Now, that could just be a trailer song. Right? Like, it could, that song may not even be in the movie. It would not be the first time that a song in a trailer does not appear in the actual film. But, like, and there's a very cool shot of the colored umbrellas, right? If that's not Singing in the Rain inspired, I would be surprised, right? Like, now that might just be me being a little bit overconfident that if you're doing a musical and there's a rain sequence, that Singing in the Rain is going to be involved in that somehow. And it would be very on the nose, which, to be fair, is Todd Phillips' whole MO, right? Like, he's not subtle. So I feel like we're not going to get the jukebox musical, but we're going to get a music video with maybe some break in that work. Because, again, you have Lady Gaga. If she does not sing, in a movie that is music influenced, you have misunderstood the assignment. Like, it's,
yes,
you know, it could not be a worse idea to cast. And not to say she's not a good actress. I actually think of the trailer, she's the part that I'm the most drawn to. I'm like, man, I can't wait to see what she does. Because I do think she's very talented. And obviously I love Joaquin. That's the thing. It's not like I'm like anti Joaquin Phoenix. I genuinely think he's a great actor. I just genuinely think Joker is not, it doesn't need to be Joker. That will always be my biggest point, is it doesn't need to be the Batman iconic character, because it's not that character in any way. It should have been an original property, and I would have almost zero complaints other than the Todd Phillips complaints. But, like, because it's still going to mirror Taxi Driver, it's still going to mirror King of Comedy. But at least then it's not also using the IP in a way that feels wrong and violating.
It's manipulative, yeah.
Yeah, because again, people can argue, oh, well, it's his interpretation. It's like, no, it's not his interpretation of the character. It's a complete alteration of the character, and then using the same name. That is not the same thing as a reinterpretation or a reimagining of a character. It is, again, I created this, and no. And again, he admits to saying, I have read quotes where he says, I knew it would get butts in seats. That's why it's the Joker and not.
I've seen that quote.
Yeah, so no,
they go hard with the Joker imagery. I was going to ask you, JB, because I've just been checking out some reactions, some written reactions whilst you were chatting away. And a lot of people are, and again, this isn't me saying either way that you're right or wrong. It's not my place. A lot of people are saying that final shot was exhilarating, breathtaking, gave them goosebumps, which is a shot where Harley Quinn goes to visit Arthur Fleck in prison or in Arkham. And she draws the lipstick on the window, and he smiles from behind it. And, you know, the lipstick on the window goes over his mouth, so he looks like the Joker. A lot of people saying that is insane, incredible. And I'm not being hyperbolic there. It's what I'm reading. What did you think of the moments like that? What do you think of cinematography? What did you think of those moments where they use that Joker imagery and iconography so blatantly like that?
I don't know. Based on the first movie, it annoys me because the first movie, everything that was Batman related felt crammed in to another movie, and this doesn't feel that way in the trailer. It feels like it's front and center, like the Batman of it all is, like, or all of the DC, I guess, to be more accurate, like familiarity, like the Arkham references and the Harley Quinn and Joker relationship, that feels front and center in the trailer. Will it feel that way in the actual movie? That will like heavily affect my take on it. Whether is it being used lovingly and in reimagine, or is it just being used again to market and sell people on this idea? Because I totally could see the classic, if we're talking the origin of Harley Quinn as a character, if we're going Batman the Animated Series, I could totally see them doing a musical episode with that Joker and that Harley Quinn and it working. Yes. So if we're going that direction and that's what comes across in this movie, then I'm all in. If it feels like there's Batman set trappings or whatever, set dressing, and it's just there for that reason, and then when everything else is going on just feels like a generic love story or a generic musical, it will upset me. It will bother me because it'll feel, again, like the only reason this is Harley Quinn and the only reason this is Joker is because it has a built-in audience and not because he has something to say with these characters or thought it would be a fun... Because, again, especially if you do look at the Birds of Prey specific Harley Quinn, and I do think that's the one where she has the most... She's like the main character in both Suicide Squad movies, but in Birds of Prey, it's like actually like a character study more or less for Harley Quinn, and specifically her toxic relationship with Joker. That is the big thing, right? Like the Harley Quinn Joker relationship is not supposed to be an admirable one because he treats her terribly. And, the whole idea of their relationship is founded on him manipulating her and he's constantly abusing her. Whether physically or more, you know, emotionally.
Mentally,
and so the idea of this is like, is this going to be a genuine love? Are they going to flip it? Is she going to be manipulating him? Or is
I
it
think
going
that is
going to
be the case. I think she's going to be the bad of the film, kind of where, but that is what I think is whether or not, how do I put this out, sound like an absolute douche, but I can't. I don't think Todd Phillips, I don't know if he'll do that or not, because I don't know if he thinks the audience who want to see a Joker film don't care about that. They just want to see Joker and Harley doing their thing. Whereas in reality, like everything you just said was spot on there. Their relationship isn't something that should be celebrated. Is it a pop culture? Is it like famed pop culture iconography? Yes, it is. But obviously it is built on toxicity. Now, I'm not saying everybody who goes to watch Joker is built on toxicity. Absolutely not. But will Todd Phillips approach it in that way where actually they don't glamorize it and Harley Quinn isn't a good person? Just like Arthur Fleck, you can argue whether he's a good person or not. I don't, you know what I mean? I wonder if they'll do that or if they'll just go down the let's try and give people a cool couple that, you know, people look back in 10 years and are like, yeah, I want to cosplay as those guys still. I want to be those guys. That's my worry, because what you've just said is so pertinent to the relationship and the chemistry and everything that the history of Harley and Joker is built on nothing good. I am very interested to see where Phillips goes with that and how he leans into it, or if he does at all, JB.
Yeah, and that's the, like you said, I think that's, we're being a little generous, I think, based on the history of his filmography to even say he might get that.
Yeah.
And that's the
never
concern.
Say never.
Never say never. You never know. And again, I would not have expected Todd Phillips to want to make a musical. If he had been at CinemaCon and been like, I grew up watching like Singing in the Rain and I'm so excited. But instead, the way he responded to questions felt more like he was like, I like music videos from the late 90s and early 2000s. He didn't say that, but that was like the vibe I was getting. I'm like, and based on the trailer, I'm like, this feels more like a music video and less like a musical. Cause there is the shot of Joker sitting with a microphone, right? Which implies, oh, he's going to sing. But then I'm like, but he's a stand up. Yeah. So is he actually holding a microphone to sing, or is he holding a microphone to make a speech or to tell a story or to make a joke? And all of the above is possible. And that's the thing, we won't know, because the trailer does not show a single character singing.
But no, it doesn't. It shows him dancing. And I didn't like when they were coming down the stairs doing the Joker kick down the stairs. I thought that was, it's Todd Phillips. I thought that was too on the nose.
Well, and of course, that scene he references as part of like, oh, there's music in the first movie. He's like, I think maybe them calling it a jukebox musical a couple of weeks ago might prove to be a mistake. It might be a movie with a very, I would not call Baby Driver a musical, but it is a very music-influenced film, right? The songs, literally, Edgar wrote the scenes to the music. So that they would be at the rhythm, but the characters aren't singing or performing those songs. Even though Baby is listening to them, most of the other characters are unaware that music is on. We hear it and Baby hears it, but everyone else is most of the time oblivious to it. Yet it has a musical element to it. I don't know if Phillips has put that level of detail that Edgar did, where like still, I would even say still different, but the soundtrack is very influential. Yeah. I don't think the overall film is as music, like, because all of the cuts and all of the movements and actions of the characters in Baby Driver are synchronized to the music, right? Where I don't think that's exactly the case in Guardians, but yeah, the soundtrack pull, like, they're really good songs and they fit the moments really, really well. Especially, I mean, the last movie, the freaking Beastie Boys song is incredible for that action. And obviously the I don't even remember what the song is right now, but the first song we hear him listen to in the first movie is such a great scene.
It felt, and that's what I wonder how this will feel. How organic would it feel? How much of it will be rooted in reality as well? Because I think if I'm like something folie à deux means something like you shared illness, shared psychosis, something like that. So I'm wondering how that will play in, if it will be literal. And if it is mostly setting dream sequences or in their head, then, I mean, listen, this could be great. And I hope it is. Why? Because I'm always rooting for Gaga. But, yeah, and they're putting it in Oscar season, so they've got high hopes. But And again, I'm glad they're not just doing a straight up sequel, JB. I'll say it again.
Yeah.
If they just did Joker 2, which was the same as the first one, then you know, miss me of that. But at least they're swinging for something different. Whether it works or whether they go all in remains to be seen. But I do respect that they're trying something different.
Yeah, we've probably given that trailer way too much of our time. So let's move on. We're both apprehensive for Joker Folie à Deux, but hopeful again. And I really do hope it's a true musical and not just a music video where, you know, we have characters doing things to song. I really hope they are performing the songs. Again, you cast Lady Gaga, please use her correctly. Not to say that she has to sing in every movie. She's capable of acting for sure. But a movie that has music at the focal point and her not singing just feels wrong. So
don't subvert that.
Let's go to our next segment of the show, media consumption. This is movies, TV, video games, music, podcasts, etc. that we use to pass the time between recordings. Matt, I need to know, what have you been consuming?
Not an awful lot, JB. As I mentioned, I've been so busy doing everything else that by the time it gets to putting my feet up in the evening, I haven't even put on any of my comfort films. I've just been watching, I've only watched a few things, but before that I've been watching and listening to Dead Meat and Double Toasted on YouTube. That's what I've been doing more so this week and this weekend, JB, is I've just had YouTube on and I'm watching people make really nice food, which I'm never going to make, but in my head I'm going to. I'm watching different commentators or creatives talking about films I like, or talking about Star Wars series I like, The Bad Batch. I've been watching that. I watched the new one today, enjoyed it. So I've kind of been, that's what I've been watching. I've just been consuming other people talking about things I like more than anything. But I've seen a couple of films. I've been sent a few films from the Overlook Film Festival, which I need to finish watching. But one of them was called Bird Eater, which involved no birds being eaten. But it was an Australian psychological thriller or psychological drama, side drama rather than a horror. But it's one of those great horror films where the horror is actually just from the characters and their mannerisms and their behaviors. As a film, I thought it was pretty decent. It basically about male toxicity, toxic masculinity, but before anyone screams woke or anything like that, this is great. This is done really, really quite well. But the film went on for too long for me. The second half is very decent. It kind of goes real bonkers, but the first half is similar to what you said about the first Omen. And maybe, you know, they can trim some stuff. Some character stuff didn't need to be there. Did it pay off in the end? Kind of. But I thought it was a very good study on toxic masculinity that didn't feel like it was trying to talk down to me or anyone listening. It was a very decent film. I also saw Kung Fu Panda 4, John. Last week was half term, which I mentioned on the episode last week. So I had my kid and she liked going to the cinema. Last thing we saw was Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. She very much enjoyed that. And last week she said, is there anything on at the cinema? So I had a look and I was like, well, I can't take you to see the first Omen. Probably shouldn't do that. I don't think you'd be able to watch certain other action films that are on at the minute. And then an advert came on during the week for Kung Fu Panda 4. And she's like the look. She hasn't seen the other ones, but she liked the look of it. And was like, oh, I'd like to go and see that. And I thought, is it just because you want ice cream? Either way, so do I. I'll book the tickets. So we went to see Kung Fu Panda 4 last Thursday. Pretty weird. Kung Fu Panda 4 Thursday evening. The first Omen Friday lunchtime. Very odd. Not much time between them. Very different films. And, you know, I enjoyed Kung Fu Panda 4. She had a good time with it. I enjoyed it. It's, you know, it's been what, nearly 10 years since the third one. And this one, it's perfectly decent. And I always say that an awful lot. And it does seem like a cop out, but it is. Is it as magical or as fun as the other three? No, I don't think it is. But does it have some fun moments in it? Yes, it does. It's got some cool moments. Awkwafina, I like. I know a lot of people seem to be jaded on her, but I like Awkwafina. She's doing her stick and I enjoy it. Jack Black's having a great time. It's not as innovative as some of the other animation films I've seen in recent years, but it made me laugh. It entertained my kid. It's very much a sort of, it's 6.5, 7 out of 10 maybe, because it's okay, John. Other than that though, haven't really been doing an awful lot. I was looking around then thinking, what else have I watched? I watched The Bad Batch, the Star Wars animated series, coming to an end now. 3 episodes left. I enjoyed today's one. Hopefully it's setting up for a big finale. Otherwise, that's about it, JB. I'm looking forward to seeing next week's film. I'm going to check that out tomorrow or the day after. And next week I'll be able to talk about 3 other Overlook Film Festival films I'm going to be watching, 2 of which were recommended by your good friend and friend of the show, Big Tuna. Whoop. Sent me a message saying if you get a chance, check these ones out. So I managed to acquire screeners for those. So hopefully Tuna's recommendations pay off. If not, well, we'll be having words. But so next week I'll be chatting about those. But other than that, JB, not an awful lot. How about yourself? Because it looks like you've had a busy one.
A little bit. I already mentioned the Big Picture podcast that I listened to the interview. But on that episode, Sean pointed out that Steven Spielberg and Denis Villeneuve did a Q&A for the DGA. They did a screening of Dune Part 2. And then Spielberg, who apparently is a huge fan of the lore of Dune, was asking mm-hmm. tons of questions. It's a really solid interview. It's like 30 minutes long. It's funny because there's a story Spielberg tells about him and Martin Scorsese deciding to help fund the restoration of the original Lawrence of Arabia, because there was like 30 minutes of like cutout footage. And so like basically, I'm assuming the version most of us have seen has footage that's restored solely because in the 80s, Scorsese and Spielberg invested in getting it restored and shown. And so he's like telling the story to set up a question about the sand in Dune. And like, when you hear Denise just like, holy crap, I want to know more about that. Like, let's stop talking about Dune. Let's and it's such a casual thing. It's like, it's gotta be so surreal to be Steven Spielberg. It was like, for us, that's like, you just like told a legendary story that for you is a Tuesday. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
So worth listening to that DGA, which also I didn't know the DGA had a podcast. So now I'm like, well, now I got to look and see what episodes I want to listen to. Movie wise, Blank Check podcast is covering John McTiernan. So I'm ahead by a couple weeks, but I went ahead and finished his filmography. So I caught Rollerball from 2002, I think. Have you ever seen that, Matt? The remake of Rollerball? It's so freaking bad, dude. It's so bad.
I might be watching it then.
I was so like, one, the part where you know it's real bad is because we live now and we know Chris Klein does not succeed as a leading man, right?
Like,
they tried real hard for a while to make him a leading guy, and it never
Kevin Klein as well.
Kevin Klein took in certain movies though, man. There are movies where Kevin Klein crushes.
He's a bad actor, but in late 90s they pushed him, but I don't think he quite made that top tier status.
He's a really good character actor though. He's good in the background. Yeah, Klein has never found his spot. He was used effectively in Election, and that's really the only time he works. He's in American Pie, but he's easily the most forgettable member of that cast, overshadowed by Stifler, of course, too, who was supposed to be his friend. Rollerball, he's the lead, and he makes LL Cool J not charming. Like, think about that for a second, because LL Cool J is usually just, even in the movies that are bad, he's LL Cool J. And somehow Chris Pine diminishes LL Cool J's charisma, like, because he has none. He is a black hole of charisma and just ruins everyone else's charisma in the movie. The movie's not good anyways. Paul Heyman is in it, though, which was funny.
I'm just looking at the cast.
Yeah,
John Lennon, I watched it. Rebecca Romijn.
The Sunday before WrestleMania Day 2. And so it was like jarring because he had just been inducted in the Hall of Fame on Friday night. And then by coincidence, I'm watching this. To be fair, I think he's the best part of Rollerball. Like, I was like, hey, it's Paul Heyman. He's the color commentator of the very no explanation of what is happening with that game in that movie. Like, it is just like, whatever, I guess this is a game. This seems like we meshed basketball and roller derby and then some like motorcycle, like motocross into it. It's ridiculously bad. And I've seen the original, and the original's what I remember was good. And there was like an understanding of why that was the sport, where this feels like it just became the sport suddenly. Anyways, what was pleasantly surprising to me, I really enjoyed Basic, which is McTiernan's last film. John Travolta and Sam Jackson. I knew it was like, I assumed the word basic would imply is like basic training. and that it was, I knew it was a military movie. What I did not know is that it's a Rashomon style, like investigative movie where Samuel Jackson is like a drill sergeant. And he takes a group of soldiers, I think Army Rangers, out on a, it's not a routine mission, but it's like a training mission. So it's just like eight soldiers. They're not in war, and all of them die, but two, including Samuel Jackson's character. That's how we're presented the story. This is what happens at the beginning. And John Travolta is brought in to interrogate the two living soldiers to get the truth of what actually happened. Because this was, again, it's a training mission. So why are all these soldiers dead? And that's where it becomes like Rashomon, because you, this guy tells this story, the other guy tells a different story. Then you start to see like you're getting flashbacks and crossover and blah, blah, blah. Now, where it's not well written is that a lot of the twists that happen in the film are like, they're not really twists. They're just like withheld information from us. So it's, it, you know, it's like one of those things, like Sixth Sense. If you rewatch the movie, you realize that the twist was there for you to identify the whole time. This is not one of those movies. Like, you can't figure out what's happening until they tell you what's happening, because it's not in the story. Like, it's purposely withheld. And then you're like, aha! And you're like, aha! But at the same time, Travolta is having a blast with this character. He is just hamming it up. And it's, I had fun watching it. So, like, I'm not saying it's great, but it was definitely like a compelling and fun watch. And I am a sucker for the Rashomon storytelling. I love that like reference point. The duel, Ridley Scott's The Duel, The Last Duel, whatever Ridley Scott movie was that came out a couple years ago.
Yes.
I really like that one. There's like, I've seen like three other Rashomon style stories and they all seem to work for me a little bit. I think I like the way that story flows, because it's, the pacing can be really quick, even if the movie is kind of long, because you're jumping back and forth between essentially a short story that's just being retold from different perspectives. And I find that really interesting. So I would recommend Basic. Sorry, I didn't mean to go quite so long on these. I'm not going to talk about this movie because we're talking about this next week, but I saw Civil War, and I'm very excited to talk with you about it. I wrote my review and it is up at BurkeReviews.com. though, if you are, if listeners, if you can't wait to hear my thoughts on Civil War, you can go read that now.
Very excited to watch it.
Over at Disappointment Media, my review of the Park Chan-wook, he directed three episodes of The Seven, but there's a new HBO Max series coming out called The Sympathizer, which is set like right at the fall of Saigon and Vietnam. And then it uses time jumps a little bit. It goes back during the Vietnam War and jumps just a little bit ahead. Robert Downey Jr. plays four different characters, and they are extremely different. There's a lot of, it's somehow really impressive. They balance a comedic tone with a very, very troubling plot and kind of perspective of the war. Your main character is not RDJ, though. Your main character, I'm going to forget the actor's name, is playing a double agent. He is officially a South Vietnam captain, and he is a help, like a spy for the CIA, working, you know, because the CIA is working with South Vietnam, but he's actually a supporter of the North Vietnam. And so you know that from the get-go, but a lot, you know, he's trying, it's the show's ultimately him trying to find balance between those things. And they hit that on multiple layers, because he's, there's a lot of reasons why he doesn't really feel like he has a true place in the world. Really good show. Seven episodes. The first episode drops on Friday on HBO Max. And again, my review for that is up at Disappointment Media, spoiler free.
Nice.
And lastly, I did watch both days of WrestleMania. I already kind of referenced this, but I've been very obsessed with wrestling, so much so that my bloody awesome last week was that I was excited for WrestleMania. And I got to say, it delivered. I thought Saturday was good. Sunday was incredible. And I won't spoil it, even though if you follow any wrestling social media, everything has been spoiled. Like minutes after it happens, it's I'm impressed if you don't know who the current, you must have zero wrestling social media if you don't know who the champions are, because it's been everywhere. Like and to be fair, like the wrestlers were on, because The Rock was involved, the wrestlers, they were, it was getting talk on like Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon and stuff like that. So like it's exceeded its normal fan base with this big event, and again the involvement of The Rock, who is obviously much more famous than even wrestling at this point. Yes. But I was really happy with WrestleMania and super. I'm still on this wrestling kick. I'm really enjoying wrestling again for like the first time in 10 years, where I'm like slightly obsessed with it. Like it's pretty much all I'm like reading into, and even my video game playing when I have a chance has been wrestling based. So yeah, that's what I've been consuming.
Nice. Yeah, no, all I've seen is WrestleMania talk. Some people I work with have put it on their social media stories. So if I was following it more closely, then I would have been spoiled anyway. But I saw what happened. I was keeping up with it just so I know that when John mentioned it, I'd know what he's on about. But having played 2K23, I now kind of have an understanding of what's happening. But my understanding was that it went down very well. It was very popular. And it was... It brought back some of the good vibes because the industry has been going through a little bit of upheaval, mainly thanks to one man over this year. So it's good to see the premier event in sports entertainment kind of get that top billing again. And more importantly, though, I'm glad you enjoyed it, because I remember you saying last week that you're looking forward to it, but you can't talk about it with anyone. So I'm glad you can at least come on here and express how much you enjoyed it, JP. And I'm glad you had a good time watching.
Yeah, exactly. It was the right amount of content. Nice. And that is our episode for the week, folks. Except before I let Matt go, before I let him return to his probable slumber, because it's much later where he is, I need to know what you're doing to stay bloody awesome, sir. I need to know that you're making sure to take care of yourself and stay awesome. So what are you doing? What's been going on?
This week, other than packing and bagging and watching The First Omen and Kung Fu Panda and talking to yourself, JP, I found time to do a little bit of book talk over on sister show Star Wars Sessions. I've been talking to an author of the just released Star Wars book. John Jackson Miller, his name is. He wrote the Kenobi novel, which was very well received. I want to say, I don't even know when it came out, but this was pre-Disney. He did a lot of writing for Knights of the Old Republic, lots of comics back in the day for Star Wars, for Star Trek, for a Dark Horse, IDW comics as well. And he's done a few in this new canon, the new continuity. So it's just cool to get on and take half an hour to talk about a new book and just have fun listening to how a creative person comes up with a creative process, especially when it comes to dealing with Lucasfilm, who of course they keep a tight leash on stories. You can't just go out and write Luke Skywalker's adventures because it's got to fit in with the template. So it's interesting to hear how he got around that and crafted a book with so many characters. It's set 1 year before The Phantom Menace, so it's pre-prequels. And it's got Yoda, Mace Windu, all the characters you saw in The Phantom Menace are in it, Qui-Gon. It's a very good book. Very much enjoyed it. But it was just cool to sit down and just chat with a creative person about something which isn't film as well. Let's not forget that. Talking about the written medium, of which I very much enjoy in that genre, in Star Wars. So, yeah, book talk, John, was a nice little deviation from packing. But what about yourself, though, my friend? Was yours more intriguing?
I don't know if it's more intriguing, but my daughter turned 20 this past weekend on Sunday. So we made it was funny because we went shopping, I think, Thursday or Friday night last week. And my daughter was like, she's not like a big sweet tooth person, especially icing. Like, she's not like a big, like some people when they get a slice of cake, they want the slice with the most icing on it. She is not that person. So she was like, I don't really want a cake. Maybe I'll just do donuts. So she tells me that. But neither of us tell my wife that. So on Saturday, when I was at school and my daughter went to lunch with her boyfriend to celebrate her birthday, my wife bought a cake. So we had a birthday cake, which was delicious, like such a good birthday cake. So the plan was, so Saturday was not her birthday. Sunday was her birthday. But my wife bought the cakes on Saturday with it while they were out of the house. She decorated for her birthday, a big celebration of Taylor. And then on Sunday, I was making steaks for the family and baked potatoes and salad and asparagus. And then now there's cake, but I already promised Taylor donuts. So Sunday morning, I went to the gym, and then on my way home from the gym, I stopped at Dunkin' Donuts and got 12 donuts, which we definitely didn't need 12, but I got 12. And so this weekend was way too many sweets, but they were very good. I can't sit here and act like I didn't enjoy eating both cake and donuts this weekend. And the steak was also delicious. But you know, we celebrated, but quietly and kind of just our family. You know, my wife loves buying gifts, but she is the worst at keeping them until it's time. I think at this point she doesn't even bother to wrap most gifts. Christmas is a little bit of the exception, but like usually, like if the holiday's coming up within 3 to 4 days, you're just going to have something that she's gonna be like, "Hey, I got you this." And it's like, okay. I think it's great. It's very funny. It's such a personality trait of hers where she's really excited that she got you this and she just wants you to have it. She doesn't want to wait. She doesn't want to wrap it. She's just like, here you go. And that was kind of I know we got Taylor stuff. I actually have no idea what at this point, because Kathy gave it to her all ahead of time. So I didn't like, there was no like
bad move that is.
Yeah, there was no moment of like unwrapping where I'm like, oh yeah. So I just like, I'm like, I know we got her stuff. Good enough. She's 20 at the same time. Like, it, you know, we haven't done like a normal like kid birthday for a few years now. And unfortunately for her, like she turned 16 during the pandemic. So like, you know, it's like the worst time to turn 16. And then she turned 18 2 years after the pandemic. So like, you know, her entry into adult life has been wild. And but, you know, turning 20, it's crazy how fast time flies. Embrace the young Olivia while you can, my friend, because you, before you know it, she's gonna be like, I'm moving out, dad. And it's, you know, time's man. Fly.
No, that's, again, I always enjoy hearing your family stories, JB. But yes, no, of course I will do it, stuff like that, which even now I'm like, my kids, what, she's gonna be 8 in pretty much a month's time, and even now I think 8, man, and I look at some, I've been getting rid of stuff like my clothes and stuff, and obviously been going through her stuff as well, so anything I can just, you know, throw out the back door we don't need, and looking at certain things, whether it's a cuddly toy or a t-shirt or something, where I'm like, oh, you're too small for that, but I don't want to get rid of it, you know. Yeah, you might, you know, I can't bring myself to do it, but what I can bring myself to do is, I hope my kid follows in your footsteps and has a cake, but also request donuts on a birthday, because that to me is a massive W. That's we are here to celebrate the size of that W tonight. That is a huge win. And I'm glad to hear that you got stuck in as well to the donuts, because I know you're a very disciplined chap when it comes to consumption, or actual consumption. So good on you, JB. What donuts were they?
Unfortunately, less disciplined over the last while, but yeah. So that is how we've been staying bloody awesome. We will be back next week to talk about Alex Garland's Civil War, the new A24 film that is in theaters everywhere. This is one of the rare, like, big push release A24 movies, where it is getting a massive theatrical release right away.
Yeah.
And probably a good time. There's not, April is a busy-ish month, but really 2024 is shaping up to be a like one movie a week type of year, versus like those pre-pandemic days when we got like 6 during the summer every weekend. So if you are able to go see Civil War, you should, because we're gonna be talking about it next week. In the meantime, we'd love to hear from you on social media. You can hit us up on Instagram, Threads, TikTok at Bloody Awesome Movie Pod. And Matt, where are we on X/Twitter?
We are at BAMP_podcast, BAMP_podcast.
And we are still on Facebook. If you search Bloody Awesome Movie Pod, you'll find us there, or podcast. I think you'll find it with pod as well. We are a Rotten Tomatoes approved podcast. So our reviews of films help that tomato meter go up or down. In this case, we say The First Omen, bloody awesome. So it's getting a thumbs up from us. You can follow me individually at BurkeReviews.com and Disappointment Media, where I write frequently, and at BurkeReviews on all the social media platforms. Matt, where can they find you?
You can go to whatiwatchtonight.co.uk, or just search for What I Watch Tonight across all of the socials, including Letterboxd.
And if you like what we're doing here at the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast, we ask that you take a minute and give us that 5-star rating on whatever podcast catcher you use to listen, because it helps other people find the show. With that, we encourage you to keep watching movies
and stay bloody awesome.
Blood, 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 bloody, 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 blood, blood. blood, bloody
awesome.